It's a cabin designed to spark a change, but it is only sparking controversy. A Sedalia woman built a replica slave cabin in a historically black part of town.
A few weeks ago, Marge Harlan was in the news. Harlan built a replica of a slave cabin on her property. She says the cabin, which also has what she calls a heritage garden, growing crops like sugarcane, tobacco, and cotton, is meant to commemorate the courage and resilience of African Americans. But not everybody in Sedalia sees it quite that way.
This is like a blatant eyesore to me and the rest of the community over here.
That was Sean Sims, one of Harlan's neighbors. He thinks that the cabin is insensitive to African Americans like him and reinforces racist ideas in the community. So who gets to decide what's a good and sensitive way to mark painful history? I'm Brian Ellison, and we're exploring that today with historians and scholars today on KCUR's Central Standard, talking about everything from memorials to disaster victims to capturing conflicting views of the past. And we're beginning with the builder and owner of that slave cabin, Margaret Harlan. She's on the phone with us from the Rose Nolan Black History Library, which she also owns and operates. That's where the cabin is. Marge, thank you so much for talking with us for a few minutes.
Well, thank you for having me.
Hey, have you been surprised by the negative reactions you've had to this project?
Yes, I have, because while we were building it and folks would come by, because it's on a highway, it's a very prominent street, they were just interested. What are you building? We'd tell them, oh, that sounds great, and on we'd go.
And as I understand it, you know, when you finished it earlier this year, there was a sign on the front that said, "This is a slave cabin. All who enter make peace with the past and move on."
Correct.
What did that mean to you?
Well, to me it meant what it said, that this is your past, you've survived it, you're resilient, brave, now let's keep going on.
I've heard the sign went missing.
The sign went missing, and the threats to burn it down. And I was quite stunned, but we rallied around, and I had a conduit to the young black men who had yelled at from their pickups. I was able to get information to them. I wish I could talk with them, because that's exactly who I want to be talking to, the angry blacks. But do what I can, and I developed another sign with President Lincoln and Sojourner Truth, and so now it's known as the Lincoln Slave Cabin.
Marge, do you have a sense of why those young African-American men were angry about the cabin?
Yes. Yes.
Why do you think they were angry?
I think they're angry at white society, that they don't feel they've had a chance, that it's all too hard, and they're just mad. They need some time to just talk. They need to become acquainted with post-traumatic slave syndrome, which has been fairly recently developed by a woman psychologist.
But Marge, do you think they were mad at you for building this slave cabin?
No, I don't think so, because the library has been here now over 3 years, and we've never had a bit of trouble. There's never been any problem at all. I don't think they're mad at me. I'm sure that I've seen them out through the neighborhood and we've said hi. Mm. But I think they're just mad.
You've mentioned we've had the cabin here and we rallied around. Who's the we? Who do you work with on this project?
Well, I have a board and I have some folks in the black neighborhood that come in and help. But, of course, it wasn't supposed to be like this. My late husband passed away, and then Rose Nolan passed away. And so it's like, darn it all, this wasn't exactly our plan.
Rose Nolan, an African-American woman who
who
you've named that Black History Library there for.
She lived here on this spot for about 32 years and raised her son. And so we wanted to have the library built in her honor.
Marge, I know you've had a lot of reporters call you over this and a lot of people in the community talk with you about it. And I know that a lot of them have asked why you think that you as a white person should be the one to do this.
Well, of course, it's all our history. This has affected all of us, slavery and the ramifications and the white power structure, Strom Thurmond, and all of that. It's come down through the years, not that it was that long ago either, but it's impacted, I believe, all of our lives.
And did you work with African Americans, with any people of color on the project?
You mean on the slave cabin?
Yeah.
No, not specifically. I just had it built. To me, it's what needed to be done. We needed here to present it, to look at it, talk through it, and then let it go. And that, to me, was obvious. The young Black men have not been able to let it go. And that's where health and happiness is, to work through these traumas and then let them go. And that, of course, is what I did for 32 years in my practice as a psychologist in Sedalia. And it's tough. It's certainly a lot easier to go around ranting and raving, but that doesn't really get you anywhere, except, unfortunately, probably problems with the law, which has certainly affected the north side here.
I guess I think a lot of people would hear you say that, Marge, and would say that maybe that's not a great message to have coming from you as a white person to the African-American community. Do you think it matters who tells the story of something that has affected, in this case, African-Americans so profoundly?
Well, I don't know if I know how to answer that. Like I said, I think slavery has affected all of us, and certainly Blacks more specifically. And I would love to have Blacks more involved with the Black History Library, and hopefully there will come a time when that will happen. In the meantime, as a white person, I do what I can. I've been very concerned about this issue years and years and years. My late husband was on the school board in Illinois where we raised our four children and was able to get the first Black administrator hired in that district, and also the first Black on the board. And those were the 60s when times were really chaotic there. And it's hard to get rid of hate. Very, very hard, because I guess hate energizes people and then kind of keeps them going. But it's certainly not a happy way to live.
I've noticed in coverage of this story that you're the secretary of the Sedalia Pettis County NAACP.
Yes.
The president of the chapter, who has disagreed with you about this pretty strongly, is also a white person.
Uh-huh.
Would it be better for this work and for this kind of conversation about how to recognize African-American history to be led by and carried out by more African-Americans?
I would be delighted if they would come forward. The reason that Rhonda is president of the NAACP is because no black would come forward to take on that responsibility. And it's kind of the same thing with me. It would have been wonderful if blacks had decided to honor Rose Nolan or move ahead with black history, but that did not happen.
Apart from who's having the conversation, do you understand the viewpoint of those who say that this slave cabin and this heritage garden growing cotton and peanuts and tobacco is insensitive? Back in April, the Sedalia Democrat, the newspaper there, had a couple of folks comparing it to building a replica of a Nazi concentration camp and expecting Jewish neighbors to find that a fitting remembrance. Do you accept that this there might be a way to see this as insensitive?
Oh, sure. And I know the reference to the to Auschwitz, but I also know Jewish individuals who are happy to have that history presented. They don't want people to forget it. They don't want what happened to them as a race. But in terms of the slave cabin, to me, that's your past. Embrace it. Compliment yourself that you and your ancestors have made it out. This is a true memorial to your courage and your resiliency as a race. And be proud of it. And that's where I wish every black could get to. And whatever I can do to help, I certainly will.
That's Marge Harlan. She's the secretary of the NAACP chapter in Sedalia and the builder and the owner of a slave cabin, part of a black historical exhibit there in Sedalia. Marge, thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
When we come back from a break, we'll talk with some historians about all this and about the bigger question of just who gets to tell history's stories and mark history's people and moments, and how that should be done. I'm Brian Ellison, in for Gina Kaufman, KCUR Central Standard. We'll be right back. Welcome back to KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Brian Ellison. We're talking about history and about how we commemorate its moments, especially the parts that are conflicted and painful. Are some ways of doing that better than others? Randall Jelks is online with us from Chicago. He teaches African American studies at KU. And Randall, I've got to ask, what did you think when you first heard about the slave cabin that Marge Harlan, our first guest, built in Sedalia?
Well, I was struck by the kind of audacity to build that. It's nothing wrong with someone wanting to philanthropically build something around slavery. John Cummings in Louisiana has donated a significant amount of his funds to the Whitney Plantation in just north of New Orleans in Wallace, Louisiana. Mr. Cummings invited lots of people to participate in this long process, and including his research director, who's a West African, to come into the process. So the step that I would think about this is, what was the processes of having a community dialogue? There are all kinds of things about Sedalia, Missouri in the Civil War, Sedalia, Missouri in terms of at one time being known for its brothels. It's all kinds of historical issues around this that should have been sort of examined fully and brought in community. So my concern is that it wasn't so much the building of this, but the processes of it.
Yeah, you heard Marge tell us just now that she would love to have had more African Americans involved, but no one else was doing it.
And I don't know Marge, and I respect her intentions, but sometimes to get people on board, requires patient building processes. Mm-hmm. When I listened to her, I objected to her sort of referencing to get over it and I think somewhat specious argument about post-traumatic slave syndrome. I think that's a rather specious argument. It doesn't match the historical record whatsoever. Immediately after the Civil War, African Americans began to build schools, homes, churches, organizations without little help from government help. And it denies the record that what happened was that wholesale attacks on African American communities all through the heartland, Missouri, Oklahoma, you can name all the was attack on black success. So I think the good intent should be also grounded in good history.
Yeah, is it fair to say, Randall, that how we memorialize and remember slavery remains a very difficult question? It seems like everywhere in the country, even 150 years later, this is still a challenge. These questions keep coming up.
Well, first of all, Americans very rarely, particularly white Americans, rarely want to acknowledge that the United States was built off of being slaveholding. And that acknowledgement alone is very important because the framers of the Constitutions and some of the most important ones from Washington and Jefferson and many others who participated in the revolution were slaveholders. That's how they made their wealth, and that's how they built things. And Americans have a difficult time acknowledging that because somehow if they acknowledge that, they are, you know, they feel guilty or at fault for that past. One of the things I objected to the author saying getting over it, it's not getting over slavery that people are upset about. It is the continuing racism that operates in the culture and in public policy that people are upset about. It's not the past. No one can do anything about that past but acknowledge it. But it is the kind of residual result of that past that people are upset about. I mean, they're not that far from Sedalia to Ferguson, where, incidentally, Dred Scott is buried. And Dred Scott, the famous Dred Scott case, was a former slave, was taken to Illinois. He declared his freedom, sued for it, and the United States Supreme Court came back saying that, you know, in essence, that black people had no rights that should be respected under U.S. law. They were not citizens of the United States. And so I think putting something about slavery and slavery, particularly in Missouri, in context is very, very important. To acknowledge it is one thing. To build something where there might be differing opinions is to build consensus, and that would take a long time. Again, I use Mr. Cummings' example. It took a long time for that Whitney plantation to come apart because he was inviting people in to acknowledge American history, to discuss it, to be a part of it, and so forth. These are painful passes, yes, but they are the past.
Yeah, you mentioned the Whitney plantation, and I know that's not too far from where you grew up. I guess tell us a little bit about those days. How do you remember learning about some of this history? What were the ways that spoke to you and that helped you sort of open your eyes to this part of history?
Well, believe it or not, my great-grandmother lived till I was almost 5 years old. She was born July 4th, 1870. So her parents were slaves. My other relatives, my grandmother and grandfather, they all were from generations of their grandparents or parents had been slaves. So actually in my family, they had been slaves. And what I learned from them is what they did after the end of slavery. They became property owners. They built churches and schools. They built communities. And even though they were being fiercely attacked all the time, and that was a part of the story because I grew up in New Orleans that I was very proud of and still am very proud of and will always be proud of. Often the story is told about Black people not accomplishing anything. You know, the mythic story of the lost cause of the South dominates what we know about African Americans. The truth is, you know, Abraham Lincoln was forced by former slaves crossing in over to Union side, forcing him to make decisions, military and strategic decisions about slaves' freedom. And they were making decisions about that.
Are there particular monuments or memorials that were part of that learning or that growing awareness for you?
Well, sure. I mean, I grew up uptown New Orleans, not far on the St. Charles streetcar from Lee Circle. Mm-hmm. I mean, I grew up looking at Beauregard and Robert E. Lee and all the Confederate generals you want to name.
Treated as honored heroes.
As honors, yes. More honored than citizens who were heroes. There were no statues to Homer Plessy, who had fought Plessy B. Ferguson, who lived in Treme neighborhood of New Orleans. There were always statues of these generals, reminding people that this was about white domination in the South. This was white supremacy and white elite supremacy at that, not just ordinary people, but white elite supremacy. And this is what I grew up in the shadow of, having the counter story being told in home, in church, through Negro History Week, which was long preceded what we know as Black History Month, in churches and schools. So I had a counter narrative to the general American history.
And can you identify the impact that those statues had on you as a young man?
Well, for me as an adolescent, you know, it was sort of resenting those statues, the way those memories were framed, as though the South had fought a noble battle for states' rights, when the very documents of the Confederacy argued that what this war is about, what this breaking away from the states were about, was slavery. And I'm, you know, as a youngster growing up in the era of the Civil Rights Movement in the 1960s and being formed as an adolescent in that era, very much became cognizant of the way that monuments shape people's memory. And even if the factual history is true, people remember the kind of what is in popular culture.
Mm-hmm. I want to see if we can find examples where our guests think history is being marked or remembered well or not so well. And I want to invite our listeners to offer their thoughts on that as well. What memorials or monuments speak to you in the Kansas City area and why? Write to us on Twitter. We're at KCURCST. Or you can call us. We're at 816-235-2888. That's 235-2888. Let me bring in Monroe Dodd. He's KCUR's resident historian. Monroe, always good to see you.
Good morning, Brian.
What do you think of as some of the more significant historical monuments or markers around Kansas City?
Well, some of the more significant ones are certainly the Liberty Memorial and World War I Museum, the Shawnee Indian Mission, the Harry S. Truman Library. All of these things were the result of someone with a passion thinking we ought to mark history. But that kind of person can differ depending on what the project is. If you go west to Abilene, Kansas, you see the Eisenhower Museum and Library. Now, you think of it as a government institution, but it was pushed largely by friends of Dwight Eisenhower, who had plenty of money and were interested in seeing the story told a certain way. The same is true of the Truman Library, which does an excellent job of telling about the presidency and things. The same is also true of historical markers all over town. A group called the Native Sons of Kansas City, renamed the Native Sons and Daughters of Kansas City, has put up a 100 or so markers in various places.
And who are those people? Are they self-selecting?
Well, they were self-selecting for a long, long time. In fact, at one time they had an office in City Hall, but they were almost entirely men. They were definitely entirely white, and they had a certain view of history. And that's the, I think that's one of the things we see in historical memorials and markers and other things. You typically can't escape your own biases, and sometimes you can't escape your own prejudices without a great deal of effort. Some historical markers, such as the ones for the Battle of Westport that say General So-and-so's troops attacked General So-and-so's troops here, pretty straightforward, and don't get into too much description of the context. And certainly, unlike the cabin in Sedalia, not that much prescription for what ought to be the way you look at stuff. They are straightforward things. Other markers are a little bit more difficult. There's a group called the Chouteau Society that saw a lack in Kansas City of any recognition of the French, the earliest French settlers, and has placed a dozen or so markers in various places to talk about them. So it kind of comes back to who has the passion for it, who has the money for it, and the time for it to do stuff. There's not a great historical marker, a moving finger in the sky that makes all these things. It's done by people, and those people have their flaws.
I think about something that, I don't know, maybe seems somewhat less controversial, like the Liberty Memorial, a tribute to World War I veterans. But even that involves a particular political perspective, right? A particular viewpoint of history.
That's right. And it also involves whose role in the war are you discussing? Are you discussing the role of black soldiers as much in World War I? That role was ignored for decades. But are they discussing enough? I think those guys have tried very hard because of a broad-based they cast their nets widely for information and for support. And also, historians have had time to develop all that. And also, the World War I Memorial, at least the World War Museum part of the Liberty Memorial, is a result of a more modern age, and always we become more sensitive to things in the past. As a former director of the Kansas Historical Society said, history is a tricky business. What happened in the past doesn't change, but how we look at it changes.
Mm. Randall Jelks from KU is still with us. And you teach African-American studies. Is there something different about commemorating African-American history and something like slavery than there is about commemorating something like World War I?
Well, I mean, you know, that's a sort of a tricky question there. First of all, African American history is American history, and the reason we separate it out is because the American historical field, the professional academic historians, for a long time, and I would argue even today, was a fairly exclusive organization of white male elite historians who wanted to tell American history in a certain national kinds of ways, and that that still is evident in what my colleague has said in the way monuments are put up. There are political agendas in history, and we all ought to acknowledge that history is about interpretation. And so there are political agendas in history to tell a certain kind of story. And, of course, my generation of scholars come along and saying, well, we would like to tell a different kind of story, one that more completes the American legacy, that it is not, you know, just a apple pie and 4th of July flag waving. There is a much more complex history of race and colonialism and settler colonials and the removal, Indian removal or genocide. So we want to tell a different kind of story, not any less patriotic, not any less that the country is good and that there are aspects of democracy. I mean, you know, the story that I want to tell is the most democratic people, and I would argue, have been in the United States, have been African Americans, because they have every reason to fight for the extension of inclusion of all people into the polity, having been excluded from the polity for so many years. So history is full of, like, monuments are full of politics, and we ought to acknowledge that as well.
Randall mentioned the Native American experience and how that is sometimes fraught. And you mentioned specifically, Monroe, the Shawnee Mission historical site. I have to admit, I haven't been there. It's not very far from where we are now. But how is that commemorated, and how does it get at some of the sensitive questions around the interaction of white settlers with Native Americans in this area?
I think it's commemorated fairly well, fairly sensitively. But the problem with any commemoration is perfection is not possible. I think Thomas Johnson came to that part of the world, and yes, he educated young Shawnees whose families had been moved there from the East by the government in return for annuities. But while he educated them, he also used them to help them grow crops, which then he turned around and sold to merchants in Kansas City and made lots of money. He also owned slaves. But his name is on a county in Kansas, which wound up to be a free state. There are so many conflicting things going on. If you have a broad-based set of knowledge about a topic, and you tap that, just as they talked about the Whitney Plantation, not only knowledge but experiences and cultures, and if you also then proceed to try as much as you can to describe it, I think you can come close to succeeding, but never achieve perfection.
I know that living in Lawrence, Randall, you've had some pretty significant historical events that are commemorated there, often with many of these same questions about how the story is going to be told, depending on the perspective of who's telling the story.
Sure, absolutely. I mean, the story often is told in Lawrence of Quantrell's raid, sacking the town of Lawrence. Lawrence was burned down twice, and that gets told. It gets told from the perspective of course, the white settler community of Lawrence, but it never gets told from those people who had crossed the Kansas River and escaped bondage, and what was their experience like of Quantrell's raid. Or other people who come from Lawrence, who deserve the telling of their story. Of course, stories are always are missing, and they do represent power positions. Who gets to pay for those stories? Who gets to enshrine their stories? I mean, this is an ancient story. You travel in Rome. Who gets to enshrine you on a building or enshrine you in the piazza is, of course, about power and wealth. But at least we ought to tell that story, too, behind the story, behind the monument. And oftentimes those are not told. And when you do want to tell those stories, this has been the people get upset when students at Princeton said, "Look, Woodrow Wilson was a segregationist. We want to take his name down." People said, "Well, look, they're trying to be politically correct." But if your family, for example, had been one of those people who lived in Washington D.C. when Woodrow Wilson's administration segregated it, and your father lost his job in the post office for that. That resonates in a different kind of way. It's not though we don't have the descendants of people. If you lived in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and your grandparents were a part of what euphemistically called the Tulsa Race Riots, which was a program against the Tulsa black community. If you had that in your family's history, you wouldn't be so easy to forgive that. And most of the my friends who are Jewish aren't easily forgiving about the Holocaust. So we ought to think about those things in ways that we still have the history is not dead. Sort of the paraphrase Faulkner, it's still with us, and we ought to be mindful of that. We're talking about both past and present at the same time.
It's time for us to take a break. When KCUR Central Standard returns, we'll try to figure out the best way to commemorate history. We'll take your calls at 816-235-2888 about historical markers or memorials in town that stand out to you. Where there are conflicting views, how do we hold them in tension? I'm Brian Ellison. We'll be back in a moment. KCUR Central Standard is back. I'm Brian Ellison, along with Randall Jelks from KU and Monroe Dodd, our resident historian, and we're talking about how we commemorate history in public spaces, how we remember it, and how we mark occasions and persons and places. We have a call from Joe in Kansas City, Missouri, who has thought of a couple. Joe, welcome to Central Standard.
Thank you. I'd like to mention three sites in around Kansas City that are very important to African Americans, in my opinion. And on the national level, we have the George Washington Carver Monument, which was, I think, one of the first. It was proposed by Harry S. Truman. It's in Diamond, Missouri. And also on the state level, we have Island Mound, and that is the site where African Americans had the opportunity to fight for the freedom in Missouri. It's in Bates County. And also we have in Bud Park in Kansas City, Missouri, an American Legion fountain, which is unusual in that in 1921, when it was dedicated, there were 12 American Legion posts, and they did have the courage to put the African-American American Legion post on the plaque. I'd also like to mention that Lincoln High School and a number of African-American churches, Lincoln High School is already on the National Register. And we have the Musicians Foundation, which goes back to the era of segregation, I mean strict segregation. It's above the National Register because it's a national landmark, and it's down on 18th, near 18th and Highland. So those are some of the places that I think African Americans today should appreciate, and more should be learned about them. And I think there's been maybe some type of progressive movement in Kansas City based on, you know, the American Legion, based on the Historical Society, Jackson County, the State Historical Society, to preserve and uplift our history.
I appreciate that, Joe. And stick around for a second. I want to ask about a couple of these monuments and memorials that you mentioned. You mentioned the national monument, the George Washington Carver site. Randall Jelks, I know you've done a little research into that.
Yes, I've been to the site down in Diamond, Missouri, and it is remarkable because it was the first sort of national park site named for an African American. What I was struck by was the kind of lack of interpretation about slavery in Missouri. I think we ought to talk about slavery in Missouri, and that's very, very important. Missouri was a slaveholding state. And that aspect of it, I thought, could have been a lot better interpreted with new scholarship that's come out about slavery in Missouri. I think that it's an important to talk about this for every American. Yes, of course, African Americans want to tell a narrative of uplift, and I fully appreciate that. I grew up, it taught me pride of community and other things. But there are also other sides of this, is that people created lives out of an oppressive, a legally sanctioned state organized system of to support slavery as an economic entity, and Missouri was a part of that. And I would love to see more people discuss that aspect of history as well, not to exclude the other parts. And I think it's remarkable. I've been to the Lincoln School in Kansas City, the musicians' unions, and those are all very important. But I'm always struck that it's often excluded from the larger discussion about how Kansas City was run, or who ran it, why. Why was Kansas City segregated? What mattered in Kansas City? What was the Pendergast administration like? All of those kinds of important questions that we can use for teaching. That history off of 18th and Vine is as much a part of the history of the city and of the nation as anything.
Joe, I want to thank you for that call. Thanks so much.
Okay.
And I want to ask you, too, Monroe, about another place that Joe mentioned, this in Bud Park, the fountain that includes a plaque for African-Americans in the American Legion. How unusual would it have been in 1921 to be honoring African-Americans in any sort of Kansas City historical marker.
What Joe's talking about is that the Post, the African-American Post, is even mentioned. Until the 1950s or 1960s, one of the biggest problems with memorialization of our past was that whole groups were not mentioned. Or, as Professor Jelks has pointed out, whole groups were mentioned maybe in the wrong way. Native Americans have had quite a few objections to many of the historical markers that appear along the highways in Kansas, for instance, because there were historical markers that at one time talked about the settlers had to face down Indians, cholera, and starvation. So Indians, cholera, and starvation, but the Indians, the Native Americans particularly, and Haskell Institute have pointed out, well, they had to face down these settlers who were coming into lands that they were quite accustomed to being free to roam in. The historical markers in Kansas went through an entire review in the mid-90s, and I cannot tell you that they are perfect today. But some of the things that were offensive, at least in the 1990s, and we'd be even more sensitive to today, were taken out. Women objected to the description of Kate Bender, of the famous Bender family that captured travelers and bopped them on the head and took their money and buried them in a grave. The description of Kate Bender as a voluptuous woman, because that was somebody's presumption. No image of Kate Bender apparently survives to know whether she was voluptuous or not. And besides, it's insensitive in today's point of view.
Interesting. Let's take another call from Man in Kansas City, Kansas. Man, thanks for calling.
Hi. We have all kinds of history here. Here in Kansas City, Kansas, we have a statue of John Brown. I know there's one in Osawatomie, but I think those are the only two. And it's real close to the Quindaro ruins, and there's Civil War-era graves there. We also have the Huron Cemetery at 6th in Minnesota. It has soldiers that fought and died at the Battle of Westport, and also the grave of the first woman to argue in front of the Supreme Court. And very few people know that Abraham Lincoln was in Kansas before he was president. Uh-huh. And there's a whole room at St. Mary's College in Leavenworth about Lincoln.
And man, do you think that those statues of John Brown contribute meaningfully to an understanding of history in the region?
I think it's remarkable that there are still people who acknowledge him heroically, whether he was crazy or not, that he's still acknowledged.
Mm.
I think it's important.
I appreciate that. Thanks for calling so much.
Sure.
I guess that is a question. In either Monroe or Randall, do you think that statues, simple reminders, simple memorials, maybe without explanation, without a lot of judgment about the value of the person, does that serve a purpose?
Well, I think statues always serve some kind of purpose. But teaching serves even greater purpose. And if there's statues are there, then I would hope that social studies classes, high school history classes would be taken to them. And then allow your students to do an examination of those statues. Why were they built? What did the historical record say about this person? All kinds of ways that we could use those, even ones that we don't like, to teach. The problem in the United States today is most Americans are woefully historically ignorant. And I will say that again, woefully historically ignorant. And what happens is popular culture substitutes for a more greater knowledge of the complexities of American life and history. And so we have to do jobs as teachers. Now, the problem for us as teachers, whether you're at the state university or the public schools, you're getting your budgets cuts. You're not allowed to have the freedom to be creative and teach. But teaching is an important subject to bring up here. Even teaching in Sedalia, Missouri is an important dimension to this story.
Monroe, you're a writer, not a teacher, but I have a feeling from your reaction of knowing laughter when Randall mentioned ignorance about history that you would agree.
I won't speak for anyone else in the world, but I'm constantly amazed at my own ignorance of history as I read more about it. You know, as human beings, we love to mark things. That's why there are little wooden roadside crosses where some family member died in an auto wreck, or why you'll see a plaque on a bench. Kansas City had an interesting case in the collapse of the Hyatt Hotel Skywalks in 1981. It took until last November to dedicate a memorial to the 114 people who died in that. 200 were injured in it. It was the worst loss of life in any structural failure in United States history, and yet nothing marked it. And one of the reasons nothing marked it was Kansas City has, since the day of the collapse, had an ambivalent view toward that. The Hyatt Hotel was the property of the Hyatt chain and also Crown Center Redevelopment, which was a subsidiary of Hallmark. Hallmark was a very well-respected, clean, popular, and notable industry in Kansas City with a head guy who donated a lot of money. There were people who thought, let's not overdo this. Why do we beat the dead horse? There were survivors and the families of people who died in it who thought, this is a too important event to go unpassed. Last November, we finally unveiled a memorial to it. But these kind of things can be controversial up one side and down the other. There's a woman in Merriam who wanted to commemorate the crash of a B-24 Liberator in a neighborhood in Merriam in 1944. The only kind of air accident that I can think of that's happened in Kansas City. Yet she got a lot of opposition to that from the family of the guy who was the pilot and who mm-hmm. were aboard, because there's some thought that the pilot was joysticking it that day. Hmm. You can have controversy on almost any level when you try to commemorate history.
We had a tweet from Brian who wrote...
I just jump in there, though?
Go ahead,
because we started this about slavery, and I want to say this. I mean, you cannot avoid the question of slavery as a mere controversy. It is a fact of what built American society, what built its economic foundations were the backs of American slaves. That's not a mere controversy.
That's a
part of history that has to be told.
Well, and absolutely, and I guess I'm thinking that a piece of this is what are we avoiding building memorials or monuments or exhibits about? So, for example,
let me just add, Randall,
we had a tweet from one of our listeners, Brian, who says, Troost Avenue in Kansas City largely remains a relic of municipal-sponsored segregation, but City Hall doesn't do enough to address this, he says. And in a way, the city itself is the monument to that, but you don't see any acknowledgement of that in any sort of official historical marker. Are there other examples that come to mind for you, Randall?
Well, I think that what Monroe wonderfully described is that we have conflicts of economic interests here, and this is one of the things that we try to teach students. I mean, what happened at the hotel with the walkway collapse,
the Hyatt disaster.
The Hyatt disaster was a conflict of economic interests. Will this hurt this longer-term city's economic interest for us to talk about it? So I think that what I just don't want to escape the conversation, beginning with this question of the slave cabin, because I think there is something to be learned there about a greater American history, and I'm insistent that we not just make it a mere controversy, but that this is a very important foundational fact of American life.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. That's Randall Jelks. He teaches African American Studies at KU. Randall, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
And Monroe Dodd, KCUR's resident historian. Thank you, Monroe.
Thank you, Brian.
And finally today, we have some very special news to announce for Central Standard fans from the household of our regular host, Gina Kaufman, and her husband, KCUR's health reporter Alex Smith. They are now proud parents of a healthy baby boy. He's their firstborn, named Ari Lucian Smith. He was born Thursday afternoon. Ari and Gina and Alex are all doing well. They've shared a photo that we're going to post on KCUR's Instagram feed. I know that they're grateful for all the support and good wishes they've received. So now to Gina and Alex and Ari, I say, you all take some time getting to know each other. We will take care of things around here. Congratulations and mazel tov to you. That's it for Central Standard today. You can find this program and all of our others online at kcur.org/centralstandard. Check that out this afternoon. You can also find us on Twitter anytime. We're at KCURCST, and I'm at PTSBrian. Join us tomorrow for another edition of Central Standard, which is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Sylvia Maria Gross. Our team includes Suzanne Hogan, Jen Chen, and Andrea Tudhope, and our intern is Anna Sterla. Gina Kaufman's on leave. I'm Brian Ellison. Have a great day.